Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear me.
I was supposed to have a piss play date tonight, but my date canceled just now, and I just drank like a gallon of water.
That and more. But before that, I want to remind you there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. ZipRecruiter.com/risk. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards and scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience to apply. 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/risk. That's ZipRecruiter.com/risk. ZipRecruiter.com/risk. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Also, you probably don't have all that much time to be going to the post office dealing with traffic, parking, lugging stuff around. It's a hassle. That's why you need Stamps.com, one of the most popular time-saving tools for small businesses. With Stamps.com, you simply use your computer to print official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send. Once your mail's ready, you just hand it to your mail carrier or drop it in the mailbox. It's that simple. With Stamps.com, you get 5 cents off every first-class stamp and up to 40% off priority mail. Not to mention, it's a fraction of the cost of those expensive postage meters. No wonder over 700,000 small businesses already use Stamps.com. We've been using it at Risk and the Story Studio for years now, and it's a no-brainer. We love it. And right now, Risk listeners get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Risk. That's Stamps.com. Enter Risk. Now here's the show. Hello, kids. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is Tommy Seebach behind me now with a song called Sex Bubbles. Bubble sex. There's a lot of bubbles on this episode, tiny ones and otherwise. We're calling this week's episode Daddy Issues, because there's two stories about real fathers, and then there's one story about me. You know, daddy is the kind of thing you would call a gay man with one foot in the grave. But thankfully, I am not having children. I am content to spend the rest of my days attempting to raise myself. Now, in a little bit, we are going to hear an extraordinary story that was told by a first-time storyteller at our recent show in Cleveland, Rick Dean, who you can find on Twitter at RDG3PO. But before that, a little something from me. This is a story that I told at our New York City show at Caveat in January. This had just happened, and so I was just kind of trying something out here by sharing this for the first time, and I just loved the energy of the audience that night, so let's throw it out there. Here I am at Risk live in New York City with a story we call Ginger Bear and the Moviegoer's Knee.
I'll tell you one thing. The show is almost 10 years old now. And one of the things that I've been realizing is kind of weird about having done the show that long is that I find myself kind of worrying about maintaining the reputation that I have created for myself through the show over the years. For example, in 2009, when I started the show, I wanted all the listeners to know that I am one kinky motherfucker. I would tell story after story about how if there's an orgy to be had, I'm going to be there. If there's some bizarre new kink that came around, I am going to try it as long as it's legal. But next month, I turn 49, okay? And one of the things I'm noticing that is different now than I was in 2009 when I started the show is that a lot more of my income these days goes to doctor visits. I was at a physical therapist a few months ago, and the first thing I noticed is, oh, great, he's half my age. And I said to him, listen, why does my knee hurt when I'm sitting and just watching a movie in a movie theater? And he said, oh, well, I'll tell you, men around your age, you know, once you get to be around 50, a lot of guys, they experience what we call moviegoer's knee. I was like, wait a minute, what the fuck? That's literally what it's called? What is this? He's like, yeah. You see, being in a seated position can be a little too strenuous for a guy your age. So I'm like, oh my God, what the fuck is happening to me? So I start taking yoga classes to kind of counter this apparent falling apart that I'm doing. And I quickly learn in yoga classes that I have no balance whatsoever. I am the guy trying to keep from falling apart, but in yoga classes is always falling down. I had to go from yoga class to yoga class to yoga class because I would quit a class out of embarrassment, because I can guarantee you there is going to be a moment in any goddamn yoga class where that instructor is going to burst out into an uncontrollable fit of laughter at me. So, a few weeks ago, I'm on vacation in one of the most sexual cities in the world, Bangkok, Thailand. And I was so excited. When I got to Bangkok, I just said, oh my God, one of the first places I'm going to go is this place that's called Babylon, this gay sex club. I got there and I'm pretty convinced that it's the largest gay sex club in the world. And the reason I say that is because it's the largest gay sex club I've ever been in. And I have a lot of empirical research in my background. But the thing of it was, it's the kind of place where everyone is naked except for a towel. So I show up and I'm in the locker room, and this Japanese guy walks up to me and he says, oh, you're a ginger bear. And I was so thrilled. I was like, yes, I am. Let me tell you something. Like, a lot of people do not like to be fetishized for the type of person they are, especially if the type of person they are tends to be fetishized by a lot of people. But if you see a ginger bear and you'd like to let him know that you like his type, I can guarantee you, we kind of like hearing that once every 20 years. So I was like, oh my God, I'm so happy to meet you. And he's like, well, I'm leaving, actually. Of course, my one admirer is already out the door. But he did give me the lay of the land. He said, here's how it works. There's a giant foam party in the central dance floor area of the club. And then out of that, there's all these snaking hallways and stairwells that go to all the other parts of the facility. There's a restaurant, there's a pool, a sauna, a massage parlor, all this stuff. But the important part is those snaking hallways, right? Those snaking hallways are where there's all the little closet-sized rooms. So those are the dark hallways where guys cruise one another in their towels and then go into the little rooms and have sex. So, okay, all right. He says, have fun. And then he was gone. And I know the whole lay of the land. Well, I step out onto this balcony right out of the locker room. And I'm looking at this giant foam party happening in this central dance club bar. Now, here's the thing. Have you ever heard of these things or been to one of these things? What it is it's a big dance club, and they have these like mechanical buckets up in the ceiling, and they're all kind of just pooping out bubbles. Like, kind of like if you forgot to close the top of the washing machine, and they're just, you know, filling the whole place with more and more of this bubbly foam so everyone can take their, you know, their towels off and just dance because they're all up to their eyeballs in foam. I'm looking down at this, and for the first time ever in a sex club, I found myself saying to myself, oh, fuck, I feel too old for that. Like, it just looked like fucking chaos down there. So I walk to another little hallway and I find, oh my God, there's a jazz lounge in here. I'm telling you, this is the most insane place I've ever, it was also a hotel. I don't understand it, but I got to this jazz lounge and there are men from all over the world in towels, but listening to jazz and having drinks. And I sat down, I was like, okay, this is my speed. And I met a guy from China and a guy from Wales and a guy from Sweden. And I started having drinks and I even started having, you know, someone's marijuana. And I thought, wait a minute, what the fuck? Like, in America, you can't serve alcohol at a sex club, much less marijuana. In America, at a sex club, the fire department and the police department raid the place on a weekly basis, so they take security precautions up the wazoo, you know? I was learning that Bangkok, not so much. So after a little while of, you know, getting kind of warmed up with the drinks and the pot, I was like, all right, it's time for the main event. Let's try this cruising in these dark hallways out. So I start to walk up one of these flights of stairs and I immediately notice, what the fuck? The foam is creeping up the stairs out of the dance club into the entire rest of this gargantuan facility. So I'm like, oh, this doesn't seem good. And I'm walking up these stairs and, of course, getting a little winded because I'm me and they're stairs. And I get to the top of this hallway and I realize, oh my gosh, everyone has tracked all this soapy foam everywhere. So all of these super dark, cruisy hallways are like a slip and slide. Like, I'm the guy that's always falling down, right? And I'm in bare feet. I've been diagnosed as being, you know, a little too fragile for seated movie viewing. And everyone else is puffing out their chest and strutting around, peacocking, almost like they're like, yeah, I'm not falling down. So I'm like, oh my God, I'm clinging to the walls. And listen, in a cruising environment, in a male cruising environment, it's traditional that there is no fucking talking, right? It's all in the eyes and it's very serious, right? Now, I'm usually okay about that. I'm a very talkative person, but I usually know to keep it shut. But not tonight. I was asking random guys, aren't there handrails here? Like, isn't it too dark for there to be a stairwell going down right there? I actually approached this, like, beautiful, strong young man in front of me. I was like, I'm so sorry. Can I hold onto your shoulder while I turn this corner? Everyone's looking at me like, dude, did you forget your fucking walker? So I was like, oh my God, yeah, maybe I am in a new phase in my life where maybe sex clubs are too fucking much for me nowadays. So I gave up. I was like, oh, let's just cut our losses and go home. But as I exited the club, I realized that the drinks and the pot and the craziness in there had me in a tizzy. And I was like, I am not going to be able to handle figuring out the Bangkok subway system for getting home from this place tonight. But luckily, there's a lot of taxi drivers, a lot of cab drivers out there just waiting by their cars right outside the club. So I wave and a guy's like, I got you, sir. And I'm like, oh, my God. Okay, the evening is done. Now I can go to comfort and safety, riding back to my hotel in this cab. And that is when he hands me a helmet. None of those cars were his. He had a little motorcycle. And here's the thing. I have never been on a motorized vehicle with two wheels. I've never done that before, but over the years, I've just like trained myself to take risks because of this podcast and just say yes to things. So I was like, well, I guess this is happening now. So I get on the back of this vehicle and I immediately realize, oh my gosh, this Thai guy is so much smaller than me. Like the ginger bear was like 4/5 of the weight on this bike. And as I'm putting this together, like, oh wait, this is a little lopsided here. We are zooming off into the Bangkok traffic, right? We are swerving and careening in between cars, cutting in front of other motorcycles. I'm like, oh my God, I'm the guy who falls down all the time. If I like have a muscle spasm or I don't know, sneeze, we are going straight into an oncoming bus. So eventually I started thinking, my God, Kevin, this might be it. These might be your final moments. But then I actually did think, well, it's been a full life. You know? I mean, maybe the moviegoer's knee was the first sign that, you know, I've had my time. And then I just started to relax after thinking that, to just totally chill out and realize, my God, this city is amazing zooming past me. And then my driver started to get like happy and like showing me stuff and making jokes and telling little stories. And I mean, I was still hanging on to him for dear fucking life, but we were laughing together and enjoying it. And I was realizing, oh my God, everything I'm looking at is so fascinating and new and beautiful. And it had just rained, making things a little more dangerous even, but it also made all the multicolor surfaces of the city just shine. And for a while there, I was just in awe. And I thought to myself, holy cow, the highlight of this night is not the batshit time that I had in the sex club, but this beautiful ride home. And so he got to my hotel, and I got off the bike, took off my helmet, and I gave him a gargantuan tip, partly because I was grateful, and partly because I'm very bad at math. Everyone got very big tips the whole time. But I'm riding the elevator up to my hotel room when my phone bings. And it's this Cambodian guy that I've known for a while. He said, oh my God, Kevin, I saw on Facebook that you're in Bangkok. I'm visiting Bangkok right now too. And we're staying in the exact same neighborhood. I was like, holy shit, that's wonderful. He said, yeah. And I was supposed to have a piss play date tonight. But my date canceled just now, and I just drank like a gallon of water. He said, can I come over and just use you as my urinal? And I said, you know what? In the safety and comfort of this hotel room, you sure can, buddy. I said, but I might wear knee pads. When you come over, be sure and ask me all about my moviegoer's knee. Thank you very much.
Tiny bubble.
Slip and slip and slip and slide.
Airline. Slip sliding away.
Make me happy.
Aren't there handrails here?
Make me feel fine.
Can I hold onto your shoulder while I turn this corner?
Make me warm all over.
Slip sliding away.
Well, the feeling.
So I'm 15 years old, and my mom's picking me up from this function, and I could tell when I get into the car that she's been sobbing. That's not new to me. She says to me, Ricky, how would you feel if we moved out of the house? I said, Mom, that would be perfect. When can we do this? And she says, well, you don't understand. We'd probably have to move into low-income housing, maybe go into the projects. Mom, I don't care where we live. Where can we go? When can we do this? Well, I can't really provide for you like your dad does. We'd have to go on to welfare. I couldn't buy you the things that your dad buys for you. Mom, I don't care about that stuff. Let's just go. We need to go where we could be happy and we could be safe. And as we drive around town looking for a place to live, I'm trying to talk my mom into doing this, and I could see she's losing hope, and we end up going back to the house where my dad and my brothers lived. So my dad, he's not super tall. He's kind of short. He's stocky. He's got big, thick legs, broad shoulders, big, strong arms. And he's always lived by the motto, if you want it done right, you got to do it yourself. So I spent a lot of time growing up chopping wood with him to heat the house or to pull weeds out of the garden or working on the cars because we couldn't afford to have someone fix them for us. My dad had this amazing work ethic that outshined his family ethic by far. He was an alcoholic, and he was also abusive, both verbally and physically. One of my dad's favorite things to do was to listen to loud music and sing along and get drunk and get high. And we knew when he would get into one of these modes, it would be best to just avoid him altogether. One time in particular, I got a little bit too close to him, and as I walk by, he reaches out and grabs me and pulls me onto his lap. He says, I got you, and he starts fondling my tits. And he says, oh, these are some nice tits you're growing, Ricky. You're turning into a real pretty girl. And I'm saying, stop it, Dad. Just leave me alone. And I'm struggling to get off of his lap, and he's laughing at me, and I could smell the beer and the weed on his breath. And I don't think he was so much trying to molest me as he was trying to shame me into being such a fat little kid. And all I knew for sure was that it made me feel disgusting, and I never wanted to feel that way anymore. But it continued over and over and over growing up. And it got to the point where I used to fantasize about ways to get him out of our life, whether we called the cops or children and youth services or just ran away. And I remember one night in particular after school, we would go out behind the house and hunt. And I'm sitting in my tree stand, and on this white plastic bucket, the cold is just radiating up through my body. The gloves that I'm wearing is doing nothing to keep my hands from shivering. And as the light's fading, and I'm looking out into the general direction where I know my dad's sitting, it's getting harder and harder to tell what might be a dad or what might be a deer. And I put the gun up to my shoulder, and I peer down through the scope. And sure enough, I could see little spots of brown moving in between the trees. And I think how easy it would be if a hunting accident were to occur. But then I also think if I had missed, or worse yet, if I had just injured him, how much worse life would be for us. My last night in that house as a young adult, I had a routine where I would finish up my closing shift at McDonald's, and I would come home late at night, and I would gather up the things that I needed to be gone for the weekend and not put up with my parents. As I pull into the driveway, I cut the engine so that they can't hear the car, and I creep in through that side door that we always go in through very slowly. The whole house is dark. I could make my way through the living room to the light shining off of the clock on the VCR. And as I turn to go down the hallway, I hear behind me, "Where do you think you're going, Ricky?" And I turn around, it's my dad. He's been waiting for me. "Dad, I just got home. I'm going to bed." "That's bullshit. I know what you're doing. You're going to be gone all weekend. Well, I got news for you." And I turn to walk away from him because I didn't want to put up with that. And he's so mad at me that he grabs me by my arm and he yanks to turn me toward him. And I could feel my shoulder popping out of its socket. And this white hot pain just shoots through my shoulders, turns into rage. And I turn and I swing at him with my free hand. I miss. And that jeering look on his face turns to one of black hatred. He wants to kill me. He grabs me by both of his hands and he goes to throw me on the ground, but I'm ready for him at this point, and I take him onto the ground with me. We start to struggle and we're hitting and we're pulling at each other's clothes, and I'm not as strong as my dad, I know this, but he's drunk and I could find my escape. I get up off the floor and I run for the door, and as I'm getting into the car, I can hear him screaming at me from the door of the house, "Don't you ever come back here if you know what's good for you." Well, I know that's not going to work for me as I'm driving down the road. All of my shit's in that house. So I devise this plan to go to the police station and tell them what's going on. This is not the first time my dad's been on their radar, so they agree to escort me back to the house to get my stuff. And as I'm pulling into the driveway, of course, my dad's waiting for me. He comes out of that side door, and he's got a Remington 12-gauge with him. He's ready to shoot me. And I stop the car, and I look at my rearview mirror and make sure that my escort's with me. And as I get out, the police get out too. My dad kind of tucks that gun behind his back and starts backing up towards the house. The police get out of the car. They do their thing. They say, "What seems to be the problem?" And my dad takes this opportunity to tell them what a giant piece of shit I was. And I didn't own anything in that house, and I was trespassing. By this time, I'm so scared. I'm so shaken that I'm just grabbing whatever I can and throwing it into this tattered brown box so I could toss it in the back of my car and leave, knowing that I would never see that place for a while. And I didn't. It was several years before I talked to any of my family again. About 15 years later, I'm married. I have two kids. They're 7 and 8 at that time. We had since kind of made an unspoken truce between me and my dad. And we had fallen onto some real hard financial times. And I think as a sort of olive branch, my dad asked if we wanted to move back in and help us get back on my feet. And I think after that time, man, my dad had to have mellowed out. You know, what could be the harm? We could really get shit fixed up. So we moved back into the house, and it became quickly apparent that that wasn't the case. You see, my dad was also a recreational drug user, and he had contracted a case of hepatitis. And the medication that they gave him for the hepatitis made him violent. So they gave him another medication that would depress him. So it made for some like weird mood swings. I remember one afternoon sitting on the couch with my wife, and my dad comes bounding in from the kitchen. He's got this massive grin on his face. He says, "Ricky, I just dropped a hit of acid. How about you get your boys and we take a four-wheeler ride?" And my wife turns and she grabs my leg and she's got this panic look in her face and she's telegraphing to me, "Ricky, you gotta do something about this." And I say to my dad, "Dad, that sounds like fun, but actually Gina's gotta take the boys and go somewhere. How about I go for a four-wheeler ride with you?" And he says, "Oh, okay, that works." The last thing I wanted to do was spend time with my dad, but even more than that, I did not want my kids to see that reckless state that my dad was in. Now, the last straw for us staying in that house was one evening I was working late and my wife calls me up. Again, she's panicked. She says, "Ricky, your dad just screamed at the kids for not eating their fish dinner." And I say, "Well, of course he did, you know." And I start to think about all the family dinners we had on the house. You know, food would end up on the floor or crammed into our face, or we'd get sent up to bed or backhanded. That's just what happened if you didn't eat the dinner that was put before you. And Gina says, "I don't care. He terrified me. He terrified the kids. I scooped him up and yelled at him, 'You don't talk to my kids that way.'" And I was stunned for a second when I remembered that my kids are being raised in the same environment that I was. What was normal for me growing up should not be normal for anybody. And I said, "Gina, you're right. We have to go. We got to find a new place to live." We did. We found the perfect house. It ended up being in the town that my wife grew up in. We're living in that house right now. The rent was perfect, more than enough room for all of us, and we made plans to get out. What threw a monkey wrench in the whole thing was my mom found out that my dad was having yet another affair. Who the fuck would sleep with my dad? I don't know. He was such a surly old fucking bastard, but he was doing it. My mom, she's smaller. She's not frail, but she's weaker. Definitely weaker than my dad. Definitely, I could beat her up in a fight, no problem. She's a very gentle soul. She's always been a source of compassion and a teacher for empathy growing up. She was very artistic. She would collect all these things for all these projects that she'd want to finish. And she never finished a project. She just had tons of shit from stuff that she never finished. So if I got my work ethic from my dad, I got my creativity from my mom. But what my mom also had was this razor-sharp, sarcastic wit. And I'm almost certain that that was the reason behind half of the fights that my parents got in. So I knew right away that when my mom was going to drop this bombshell on my dad, we didn't want to be in the house. We had no idea what was going to happen. The clock was ticking. I knew my dad was going to be at a concert this coming up Saturday. He was going to be gone between 8 and 10 hours. So we had that time to pack up the entire house and get the fuck out of there before he even knew what was going on. And as I'm packing up the rooms that my boys stayed in, it was a room that I grew up in, a room that I slept in as a child. And I remembered having a baseball bat underneath my bed. And I slept with it because I wanted to be able to protect my mom and my brothers in case my dad got violent again. And then one night I was woken up around 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, the usual sounds of fighting. My dad is screaming and yelling and things are being thrown around the downstairs and my mom is sobbing. And I hear a sound that's a little bit different. It's a loud boom. And I could feel the reverberation from that shake all the way up into my bedroom. And I hear my mom scream, "Ricky, come help me." So I grab my baseball bat from under my bed and I run to the top of the stairs. And by the time I get there, my dad is jeering at me. He says, "Yeah, Ricky, go get your baseball bat. Come help your mom." And I'm standing there for a second and I'm scared and I'm ashamed and I'm embarrassed that I could even do anything about that. And I went back to my bed and I put the baseball bat back underneath and I listened to the rest of their fight. And as I was thinking about that instance, I realized that this is finally the situation where I'm picking up my family and I'm moving them out, I'm getting them out of that situation. So my mom, on the other hand, we've got the first load of truck. It was all of our stuff. It packed up easy. We were there about a year and a half earlier, so that was fine. My mom had 2 more truckloads full of just books that haven't been opened in 30 years, blankets and quilts that her mom made, and tons of cooking stuff that her grandmother had cooked with, old furniture that looked like it came exactly out of an antique shop, all of this stuff. None of it was really worth anything, but it had tremendous sentimental value to her, and she's panicking, and I'm saying, "Mom, I don't know how much time we have left. We can't possibly pack any more stuff," and she's almost crying. She's like, "We got to put this stuff in a, your wife's got a car and I've got a car." I'm like, "You don't understand, Mom. You do not want to be here when Dad comes home and finds out that we are all gone." And she says, "If I don't get this stuff now, your dad will burn down the house with everything in it." And I knew that was true. My dad had threatened that on more than one occasion, anyone and anything in the house. But I think the overall logic prevailed. I finally got my mom and my wife and kids and they all had left. And as I looked around the empty house, I started to think about how I would feel if I came home to that, not knowing what was going on. And I got a sense of guilt, and I knew that I couldn't leave my dad to come home to that, so I decided to stay behind. Jordan and I are sitting in a car across the street, and I'm going over all the potential scenarios in my head. Would he be sobbing? Would he be crying when he finds out what happened? Would I have to give him a hug? Well, that's highly unlikely, because I'd never seen the guy cry in his life. Would he go get some gasoline and try to burn down the house? How would I stop him from doing that? I have no idea. Or would he pull a gun on me? Well, I had a backup plan for that too. I had a gun tucked into the back of my pants. Shortly thereafter, my dad pulls into the driveway and we pull in after him. I see my dad get out of the car and go in the house. I follow him into the house. My buddy Jordan, he's my getaway car, hangs out in the door just in case. And as I round the corner into the kitchen where my dad's standing, he's saying, "What the fuck is this?" And his voice reverberates over the bare walls and the empty cabinets. And I turn around and he's this monolithic statue of hate and anger. And in my head, I'm just going nuts. I'm like, "Dad, you fucked up for the last time. We're sick and tired of your shit. You've been cheating on Mom. You've been terrifying my wife and my kids. We just can't handle your garbage anymore. If you want to see us again, you got to fix this shit. We're out of here." But what comes out of my mouth is a lot softer. I say, "Dad, Mom found out you were cheating. She was scared to tell you. We were scared to tell you. I'm sorry. We have to go." And I see my dad kind of melt before me. He turns into this short, confused, out of control, sad person. And he turns to me and he's barely able to look me in the eye and he says, "I'd like you to leave." And I said, "Okay." and I turned to walk out. And I realized, walking into that house, I was that same scared, vulnerable adolescent that was afraid of his dad. And on my way out of this house, I realized that he's just another human being like I am and like my mom is, and we fuck shit up all the time. And in that moment, I was able to forgive my father. Thank you.
This is Risk. This is Alice in Chains behind me now, and we just heard from Rick Dean, who you can find on Twitter at RDG3PO. Also before that, a little interstitial by our episode editor, Jeff Barr. And now I want to talk to you a little bit about Robinhood. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there's no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy to understand charts and market data and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections such as 100 most popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of Risk a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. So sign up at risk1.robinhood.com. Also, do you have a bunch of stuff lying around the house that you just don't use? A pair of jeans that was only worn once? An old phone hiding in a drawer somewhere? Mercari is an app you can use to sell all this stuff. They make it fast and easy to sell almost anything. Simply take a few pics of your stuff, add a description, and boom, your item is listed. Once it's sold, Mercari emails you a shipping label, and you just send it off. No meetups with strangers, no hassles. With Mercari, you can sell everything from fashion to electronics and toys to sporting goods. Over 100,000 items get listed on Mercari every day. Earn a few extra dollars and clean up valuable space in your home with Mercari. The app has over 300,000 reviews on the app stores with an average 4.8 star rating, so why not give it a try? Don't let that stuff you don't use go to waste. Sell it, ship it, and get paid with Mercari. You can find Mercari on the app stores or on Mercari.com. That's Mercari. Mercari, the selling app. Our final story on this week's episode is another one that was shared in Cleveland, and another one that was shared by someone who had never done anything like this before. It's extraordinary. This story deals with abusive situations. We were so proud of all the work that Layla put into prepping this story. She just did a phenomenal job. This is Layla Al-Shuja with a story we call The Girl Who Said No.
Everybody. So I'm 16 years old, and I'm seated at the family dinner table with my full, complete family for the first time in about 10 years. My father, who's seated at the head of the table, cannot stop raving about the chicken I had made. He's going, "Masha'Allah, Layla, masha'Allah, masha'Allah." You see, he's from Yemen, so he's Muslim, and this is an Arabic expression for when something's really amazing and you just have to praise Allah for it. And he's so impressed because this is the first time that he's trying my cooking, because this is his first night home from jail, where he'd been for the past 10 or so years. Long story short, he owned a business and did not operate that business in accordance with United States federal law. So that's all I'm going to say about that. So the mood around the dinner table is a little bit tense. Me and my five siblings, it's a little awkward. We don't know how to act. But deep down, I'm excited. I'm kind of hopeful. I'm going to finally see what it's like to live in a two-parent home and have a mom and a dad. At one point during the dinner, he singles me out. "Layla, Mama says you're starting this new school. When does that start?" And I instantly feel like a punch in my chest. His tone is like a cross between, like he's interrogating me or accosting me. "Tomorrow?" And he's like, "Well, why don't we just hold off on that?" And I'm just confused, like, "Huh?" And he says, just hold off. And instantly, my stomach tightens up and I just lose my appetite, because I know my dad does not approve of public school. You see, the whole time he was behind bars, my dad's greatest fear was that his six children would become Americanized. So he did everything in his power to make sure that that didn't happen. We grew up going to a tiny Islamic school that required Islamic studies, Arabic and Quran classes every day. And the hijab, the headscarf, was mandatory starting at fourth grade. All of our social interactions were pretty much limited to the small Muslim community, Arab Muslim community that we are a part of. And then in eighth grade, I was shipped off to Yemen. When I returned, it was time for me to start high school. And my mom decided to thrust me into her world. You see, my mom, she's white and she's American. She grew up in this country. She thought I should go to public school. Needless to say, I'm coming straight from Muhammad Ali Uthman School in Yemen, where I wore a burqa outside of the school and thrust right into American public school. So it was a huge culture shock. I couldn't believe all of the cussing and the smoking and the making out in the hallways that the public school kids did. Oh my God. So needless to say, I was terrified of those kids, and I was a complete nobody for my freshman and sophomore years. I would return home from school most days not having spoken a single word to anybody, and I spent all my lunch periods in the library eating Twinkies and journaling about how miserable I was. So now it's my junior year. I'm ready for a change. I'm going to this new school. And so when my dad tells me to hold off, what he doesn't know is that he's throwing a wrench into this revolutionary plan that I had set for myself, called the Come Out of Your Shell plan. I was going to go to this new school where nobody knew what a loser I was already. I was going to be my fresh start. I was going to talk to the other kids, maybe enough to make a friend or two. So I ignored my dad's cryptic warning and go to sleep. The next morning, I wake up extra early, extra nervous. I'm showering, blow dry my hair, and I straighten it, do all my makeup, put on my brand new uniform. I try to eat breakfast, but I'm too nervous. And it's time to leave. So I go get my mom. She's supposed to take me, and she's in her pajamas and brushing her teeth, which is a terrible sign because my mom is like punctual as fuck. So I was like, Mom, you ready? I need some lunch money. She responds by holding up one finger and then turns her back. And I know something's not right. And then my father materializes. And you can tell he's freshly woken up. He's got his like saggy morning look. And he's wearing his checkered folta, which is a garment that Yemeni, mostly men, wear to sleep. And he's looking grim. And he uses the same language that my mom does. No words, just fingers. Two fingers, and summons me back into the master bedroom. And I don't know what's about to happen, but I know it's not going to be good. I sit down, and my head just starts spinning. He says, Layla, I am done with this country. My head's spinning still. I already know this isn't good. This isn't good. They've taken all my money. They've taken me from my family. I've been discriminated against. I've been treated like an animal. They've corrupted my kids. I see what America's done to you. I'm done with this country. And you are too. He tells me I'm not going to school that day or the next day. I and my younger siblings would be put on a plane and sent back to Yemen. For good. Not just for the 1 year, but for good this time. I had to get out while there was still hope for me. Unlike my two eldest sisters, the people in the world I was closest to, who were off to college. They were too far gone, he said. I'm giving up on them. And we were not staying in contact with them in case they might corrupt me too. He was going to stay behind here with my mom and tie up all the loose ends, sell the house, figure out a way for him to cheat his travel restriction. And then that's it. Close the chapter of my family's life in America. I don't want to believe any of this. I'm begging, please, please, Baba. Okay, fine. Well, can I just go this week? Maybe just today, maybe half the day? But he's completely unmovable. And he just gets suspicious. Why do you want to go so bad? What's the point? Who do you need to see? Do you have a boyfriend? Having a boyfriend was the worst potential sin that I could commit. He seems confused that I'm reacting so strongly. Like, what? What's so bad about this? Don't you know what's best for you? And I remember it's so hard for me to choke out the words, you're breaking my heart, because I'm not used to being that emotionally raw, and because I'm crying so hard, I can really barely talk. He goes, that's fine. My dad's always hated tears. It just makes him even more pissed off. Do you realize how selfish you're being? You have such a small brain. You only think about yourself. What about me and everything that this country has done to me? And also, now that he'd broken the charade of the happy, loving father reunion, he just had to throw in that the chicken I'd made last night that he'd been raving about so much was actually dry and too salty. You're going to Yemen, and your chicken sucks too. Walking out of that bedroom, I learned for the first time that emotional pain can be worse than physical. My mom already knew, and she was behind this whole plan. Now, the story's not about her exactly, but she just wanted to keep the peace and be a good wife, I think, this whole time. My younger siblings were too young to protest, or just kind of like, okay, that's what's going to happen. But I ran to my older sisters crying, like, can't we do something? Like, I'm 16. They can't drag me kicking and screaming. And I said things to my mom, like, fine, you can do this, but just know that when it comes time to leave for the airport, you're going to find me with my wrists slit wide open. You'll have to take me to the hospital instead of the airport. To which my mother responded, Layla, please stop being so dramatic. And I responded to by taking my head and slamming it into the wall over and over and over again, just so he knows how serious I am. After about a week of this, my mom does join our side. And she convinces my dad to let me stay on the condition that I promised to go next year. I look him in the eye and I shake his hand and I say, yes, yes, Baba, I will. Not meaning a single word of it because I just saved my ass this time around. Like, whatever, I'll just cross that bridge next year. We'll see what happens. But thus kicked off like the worst year of my life. I felt like a prisoner in my house because I couldn't leave except for with his explicit permission. My mom's had no authority over us anymore. He revoked it. Music, specifically American pop music, it was a rare treat, only to be enjoyed when he was gone, because that was forbidden too. We were not to own electronics, take naps, cut our hair. I was constantly paranoid because he also had little recorders, and he would hide outside of our bedrooms, eavesdropping on our conversations, too. And at the end of the year, he revealed that he'd been taping and listening in on all of our phone conversations, which meant that he heard all the times me and my siblings would get on there to talk shit about him, and we'd imitate his accent. And he seemed genuinely offended when he huffed, "I don't even talk like that." Meanwhile, school is my safe haven. I'm blossoming. I am making friends and even pretend to look forward to the weekends with them. Oh yeah, TGIF. When in reality, school is the only bright spot in my life. That's what gets me to the end of the year. And at the end of the year, I even get a little rebellious and I give my 12-year-old sister a haircut. Yeah, on one condition, she just keep it tied up in a bun every time she's around him. But of course she is 12, and one night at dinner, she slips up, we're eating dinner, and all of a sudden it's interrupted with, "Did you cut your hair?" And both of their heads immediately snap to me, the culprit. And I like try to protest, but she wanted me to. But it doesn't matter. My dad snaps his fingers. He loves snapping fingers. And grabs me by the arm and pulls me down to my punishment, which is the hole, which is the basement. That was his go-to punishment, which I gotta say is pretty effective because nothing feels more fucking pathetic to be a 16-year-old in the basement sitting in timeout for the crime of singing a Christmas song. Meanwhile, my peers are experimenting with marijuana and texting boys on the cell phones that they're allowed to have. But on this particular night, I just didn't have any time to sit in the hole. It was the last week of classes. I'd fallen way behind in algebra, and my teacher said she wouldn't fail me if I completed a bunch of these assignments by the next day. So I sit for a little bit, and then I go over, "Hey, Baba, I gotta do this," and explain. He just laughs. "You're not going to school tomorrow. You're in the hole for 24 hours. Go sit down before it becomes 48. And I'm frozen. I'm standing still across from him, clutching my assignment. And the one electronic that I am allowed to have, a graphing calculator. I'm thinking, there's no way he can keep me in the hole for that long. There's no way that I'm not going to school tomorrow. And there's no fucking way I'm failing algebra. I hate that shit too much to repeat it. And the words that I've been saying since the beginning, like, "What if we just say no," kept echoing in my head. And I should mention that this whole time I was hoping that my dad's abuse would shift from emotional and verbal and psychological to physical, because then that would catch the attention of somebody. If I have a black eye or a bruise, something, it'd be like, "Look, help." So my heart's pounding, and I just say, "I have to do this assignment." And that's when he realizes that this is willful disobedience. So he kicks up the threats, 24 hours in the hole turns to 48 hours in the hole, turns into, "You're not going back to that school ever," turns into, "You're going to Yemen next week." And I'm thinking, oh fuck, now I'm in too deep. Like, I'm already going to Yemen next week. Why am I gonna give up now? After all of the potential threats are exhausted, then he just plays off of my fear of him. He gets right in my face and grabs me by the shirt, and then his big, round, dark eyes are popping out of his sockets, just like the vein popping out of his forehead. And he's screaming, "Wallah al-azim, ya kalba, go sit down, ya himara, sit down!" And I'm completely shaken and sobbing. But I'm not gonna sit down. So I just stand there and shake my head. No, no. Eventually, I'm thinking, just beat me already, please. Let's get to the part where he beats me up and then let's fast forward till tomorrow. But then when I finally feel his hands on my shoulders and my back clap against the brick wall, I let out a huge wail, even though it really didn't hurt that much, or maybe it was just the adrenaline. And then next thing I know, boom, my graphing calculator hits the wall with astonishing force. It's like a firework. Like lots of pieces of calculator and buttons rain down on the basement. It's kind of cool, actually. Eventually, of course, all this commotion attracts my mom to the basement, who just comes in and backs him up and says, "Yeah, Layla, go sit down." And it's a lot harder to stand up when it's two parents angry in your face. So I cave. And I'm humiliated when I do. I go sit down, finally. My dad smugly relaxes back in his chair, and my mom just quietly picks up all of the buttons and pieces of calculator. I'm just a vibrating pile of snot and tears sitting down when else, not after long, I hear thunderous footsteps coming down into the basement. And I hear an adult male voice that's American. "What's going on here?" Followed by the voice of my older brother. "Sorry, Baba. I had to do this." Police officer appears. And I cry even more because, like, fuck, I'm safe. But what's going to happen once he's gone? They separate us and interview us. And they ask him to leave, which thankfully he does. And he doesn't come back for like 3 days. I don't even know. To this day, we don't know where he went. But when he comes back, it's different. He's not constantly breathing down our backs. He's not being quite as crazy and controlling. Because up until now, we've all just been accepting and going along with his authoritative, all-powerful dictatorship. But now I'd made a small crack in his regime, and a rebellion has kind of started here. After the calculator incident, that's what my family calls it now, the calculator incident, my brother decided to reach out to a counselor who called CPS after they heard what all was going on in our house. So we're home a week or so later when there's a pounding at the door and the cops are back. But this time, he's removed instead of asked to leave. And they advise my mother to get something called a TPO, a temporary protection order. It's like a restraining order, but temporary. And nothing made me feel more giddy than to realize that not only is he gone, but he is legally obligated to stay away from us. But that was just all the beginning. The TPO turned into a divorce, the only word better than TPO. Over the next few years, I slowly started to break out of this shell of psychological abuse, the sheltered upbringing, the ridiculous religious indoctrination, all this fucking bullshit that was imposed on me, all at once just lifted. And I could finally become myself and see, like, who is Layla aside from all of that? And over the following year, I discovered these joys of life that I'd missed out on. I hung out at the mall with my friends, like all the other public school kids did. I jammed out to Michael Jackson in my bedroom, and I didn't even have to hide it. At 17 years old, I engaged in my first hug with a boy. Yeah. Our family did our first Christmas the following year, too. And of course, I cut my hair. And I remember after I did, I just couldn't stop running my fingers through it, looking at literally every reflective surface I walked past. So, of course, in the 9-ish years since all this went down, I've spent a lot of time reflecting on this very dramatic year. And I always think of the fate that had been determined for me, the fate that was decided for me, that I really had to fight against and reject. What would it look like if I was agreeable, like my mom or my younger siblings, if I didn't say no? I'm 25 now, so by now I most assuredly would have gotten married off, probably wearing a burqa like how over 90% of the women in Yemen do, living in a war-torn nation where it's not even an option to leave Islam. Especially get on a stage and talk about it, doing it. Almost every fucking day of my life, I look at the life I get to live, and I relish in how amazing it feels. I walk out the door without telling anybody where I'm going, or go where I want. Not only listen to American pop music, but gyrate to it publicly. Talk to boys, and so much more. And the fact that I'm just fucking standing here right now, I never take anything for granted. And I'm able, and I'm here. And and it's all because a 16-year-old girl decided to finally come out of her shell to say no. Thanks.
Thank you.
is all for this week's episode, folks. This is Wussy behind me now, and we just heard from Layla Al-Shuja. I'll tell you, I will never forget, there were a few women who jumped to their feet and rushed up to the base of the stage to show that they were giving Layla a standing ovation at the end of that story, and it was so moving to see that. Don't forget that Mercari is the selling app that makes it fast and easy to sell almost anything. You just take a few pics and add a description and boom, your item is listed. With buyers in all 50 states, stuff really sells and everything ships easily, so there are never any awkward meetups. You can find Mercari on the app stores or at Mercari.com. That's Mercari, M-E-R-C-A-R-I. Let me list for you where Risk is coming next on March 15th. We're back in Milwaukee at Collectivo Coffee. March 15th, come on out, Milwaukee. March 16th, we're in Madison, Wisconsin at the High Noon Saloon. Come on out on March 16th, Madison. And then on March 16th, we're also in Los Angeles. David Crabb hosts the show out there. So that's at the Bootleg Theater on March 16th in Los Angeles. On March 28th, we're back at Caveat in New York City. And on March 29th, we're in Salt Lake City. Now, we're done casting the Salt Lake City show. That will be at Metro Music Hall. But we are still taking pitches for the April 12th Richmond, Virginia show. So pitch us, folks, from Richmond, Virginia, or anywhere nearby at risk-show.com/submissions. And finally, on May 16th, we're coming for the first time ever to Fort Lauderdale at the Sunshine Cathedral. Now, we're especially looking for LGBT stories for that show, but they don't have to be. In any case, if you live anywhere near Fort Lauderdale, pitch us at risk-show.com/submissions for that May 16th show. Also, if you want to learn anything about storytelling, you can find our school at thestorystudio.org. All kinds of training and workshops, including corporate workshops. You can find us at thestorystudio.org. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk. That is all for this week's episode, folks. This is who is this? I forgot.
Jazz lounge.
Bubbles.
clap.